Gar are the coolest fish I've ever seen. I mean, just look at these things. They're from a tubular fossil fish family that's been around for over 100 million years. They have an arsenal of deadly fangs, they have armored scales, and they can breathe air with lung-like organs.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking to writer, fisherman, activist, and eco-minded Mark Spitzer. His new book, Return of the Gar, published by the University of North Texas Press as part of their Southwestern Writing Series, is a sequel of sorts to his first book, Season of the Gar, Adventures in Pursuit of America's Misunderstood Fish, published by the University of Arkansas Press, the first accessible book-length study of the gar in the English language.
I know I speak for millions when I write that we don't want to live in a world of dwindling fish. We want a world full of healthy creatures, especially ones that took eons to evolve. They need us. We're helping them out. And they're beginning to return.
Return of the Gar with writer Mark Spitzer on Arts and Letters. I'm J. Bradley Menick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities.
Know the water that rolls so gently. May you tread in there.
Today, we will be demythologizing the second largest freshwater fish in North America, the oft misunderstood alligator gar, a fish that can grow up to 12 feet long and well over 300 pounds. Because of their scary-looking faces and man-eating size, they've been demonized as devilfish and monsters.
The gar was cast out to make way for irrigation and agriculture, their spawning grounds dammed, their population diminished due to sport fishing. Untrue rumors proliferated about gar eating twice their weight in game fish per day, as well as urban legends about gar attacking humans.
And hold your breath that breathes so sweetly.
This propaganda led to a culture of smearing gar. Gar aren't just fish. They are also a reflection of our struggles with each other.
Mark Spitzer, writer, professor, activist, editor of the Toad Suck Review. Welcome.
Thanks, Brad.
In Season of the Gar, your first book, you took a look at why gar have been so vilified in North America. Why is that?
Gar had been run out, shot up, dynamited, poisoned, thrown on the shores, and burned en masse to the point of extinction in many states. But after centuries of myths and disinformation, the science on gar is finally being seriously funded. And here in America, we've taken a lot of successful steps to propagate the alligator gar, which is now making its comeback.
And somewhere between here and heaven, whoa, Lord, you shall be found.
So tell us about in the 50s in Arkansas, what happened to the gar?
Well, in the 50s in Arkansas, we had a sport industry that developed here in which guides began taking out tourists from all over the world. And the method was basically you fish for them with big surf reels and big heavy-duty ocean equipment, and you reel them in toward the boat, and then they shot them in the heads with guns. And they thought that this supply was never ending. But basically, at the end of the 50s, in just 3 years, this method helped just wipe out probably 99% of the population of alligator gar in the state. They were basically extirpated from the state, and we've been struggling ever since then to try to get their numbers back up because, you know, they do affect balance of the ecosystem. And fishing has suffered for the last 60 years in Arkansas.
Why were they so fished?
There's some photographs that emerged from the confluence of the White and Cache River. They made their ways all over the place, and people saw these photographs, and they were like, wow, look at those huge fish in Arkansas. It just became the go-to place to get these fish. Right now, I think the estimate is there's 500 adult alligator gar in the state. I think it's probably a little more than that. It's probably about 1,000. Back then, there must have been a few thousand. Their reproduction is so complex. It takes so long for them to get to the maturity where they can spawn. You know, it's a slow process. It's a delicate process, and it's just hard to keep that balance.
You shall be found.
I love some of the writing in your book, like this passage from your first chapter, The Spawn and Beyond.
Our guard spawned, which doesn't happen every year. When it does, it's due to a harmonic convergence of the right water level and water temperature, and the fact that those fields have to stay flooded for at least 10 days for the fry to make it on their own. In this traditional spawning ground, where gar have been breeding for centuries, successful spawns tend to coincide with major flood pulses, which don't happen every year. Yeah, according to Dr. Reed Adams, that population of gator gar only has a successful spawn once every 7 years.
I'm Reed Adams. I'm a biologist in the biology department at the University of Central Arkansas. Well, what we're seeing in the river systems we're studying right now, when the alligator gar do spawn, that they're laying their eggs, but the flood is only lasting a couple of days, so these eggs are in very shallow water, and then when the floods recede immediately, then the eggs are desiccated. So in our 7-8 years of monitoring, we have seen actually more unsuccessful spawns than we've seen successful spawns. You know, our model system right now is a fuchsia phase system, so we're still collecting data when we can, when we see alligator gar spawning, to try to figure out, well, how many days, you know, do you actually need inundation in order for alligator gar to have a successful spawn? Do they always spawn in this herbaceous vegetation? Is there a certain type of vegetation? I mean, these are things we're continually trying to answer.
And darling, darling, don't go to sleep tonight. I'll lay you down by the riverside. I'll jump on in, the water's fine. Well, I will lay you down by the riverside.
So why not try to get gator gar on the endangered species list?
That's a complicated one, Brad. First of all, there's commercial fishermen out there, especially in places like Louisiana, that are supplying gar to scientists. And unfortunately, you got to cut into a few gars to learn stuff about their physiology, their genetic makeup. And so there's some casualties of science. But we learn a lot from the data that's collected. And right now, there's sort of a gar renaissance going on with the data we're collecting. So if we were to protect them federally, we couldn't get that information, and it would be back to the black ages of science for gar, perhaps. Another problem is that some states have a lot of gar, some states don't have so much, and the populations in Texas and Louisiana right now are actually pretty dang good because of the work we've been doing to protect them. And there's just so many gar in those two states that it wouldn't work to try to get them listed as an endangered species.
Let's just step back a minute and talk to me about they're really working to collect data
mm-hmm.
all across the South, and they're using fishermen do that.
Right.
Talk about that a little bit, because it's throughout your book.
Well, scientists are going to the fishermen, basically commercial as well as recreational, to get the gars, to find the gars, to find where they are, so then the scientists can run their nets in these places. And we're getting a lot of information. Lindsay Lewis of U.S. Fish and Wildlife, he contacted me a few weeks ago, and basically someone had reported that some alligator gar had been left at a boat launch, and these were big fish, 5-6 feet long, and their heads were chopped off, and, you know, and it was really a bummer that, you know, these fish had been killed, but this was a population that we didn't know about. So Lindsay told me where the area was, and he told me because he knew that I would take my fishing buddies in there and that we'd go fishing and that we might be able to find where the population lives. And my boat's a lot smaller than some of the boats they use, and he also figured I could get in there. So yeah, I went in there and we found the population, we saw them, and I went back, I told Lindsay exactly where we'd seen them. And so this is really important information. They'll go in later on with their nets, and they'll get them, and they'll tag them, and they'll attach transmitters, and you know, maybe they can use the transmitters to follow these fish to their wintering hole, where we can collect more data. We can get some genetic information on these gars, but even more importantly, we can try to protect these gar now. Now that we know that this population is here, you know, we can put up some signs, and hopefully, if there's a good spawning ground in there too, you know, maybe we can even put some hatchery gar in there and increase the population.
What are the migratory patterns of alligator gar?
They're a lot like Arkansans in that they tend to stay close to home. because they have a deep connection with family and place. Studies from Texas show that alligator gar hardly ever roam more than 10 or 15 miles from home, and that's what we're finding in Arkansas as well.
I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and you're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's return to the gar with Professor Mark Spitzer.
Now forgive me, Tallahassee, if the angels want to ask me, how will you get to heaven if you sell your soul?
Your gar search took you to a gar rodeo in Louisiana, the Thailand to catch a monster fish, the arapaima.
Yeah.
The massive prehistoric bone-headed fish from South America. And finally to Tabasco, Mexico to learn about gar farming.
I'm as good as the road that I'm on. The sun will shine, snow falling winter, and I love you every day that I'm gone.
So let's just start a bit with the gar rodeo. Could you paint a picture of that?
For some reason, gar fishing contests have been called gar rodeos, basically because you round up these gar. And in Louisiana, they do it through jug fishing. They take like a milk jug or a plastic Coke bottle or something, and there's like some heavy-duty line or wire that comes off, and maybe 3 or 4 feet of 6 feet of line, and then a big hook, which they bait up. And people throw these jugs out all over the place. And at this particular gar rodeo, there were prizes for bringing in the biggest gar, the biggest boatload of 10, weight-wise, and I think there was something for an other category. So I went out there, and on one hand, you had all these young partying types coming to binge drink at the bar, but you also had all these people in their flat bottom boats. And so people come out to the bar and the contest begins, and then people go off for 2 days and they throw out their jugs and then they bring their gar in. But you know, how do they get these gar? Well, they get them on the jugs, they pull them in. But then the method is, how do you get them in the boat? Well, what they've always been doing, you shoot them in the head. But then the thing is, people bring in their 10 biggest gar. But what happens to the other gar that they don't bring in? Well, they're floating around in the bayou's dead, you know? So I saw over 500 alligator gar brought into this rodeo to be weighed and measured. And, you know, that's basically what the official statistics of the population of alligator gar are in our state, Arkansas. That loss of gar in Arkansas, we'd be wiped out, you know, pretty much. But that's what happens, not just at that one gar rodeo in Louisiana. There's a few gar rodeos that happen in that state every year.
It catches us when we are falling, and it teaches us how to grow. But may we find solid ground, oh, at the very least.
Still, there are those who hold to the ways they were raised, who still insist that it's okay to kill gator gar willy-nilly, to leave their putrid corpses at the launches, or break off their beaks and throw them back in. This behavior, however, is simply backwards, in the sense that it takes us back to the 30s when states like Louisiana, Texas, and Illinois published totally false anti-gar propaganda and misinformed a generation.
So may we believe in something that we may never see. And oh, Lord,
so tell us a little bit about the monster fish, the massive prehistoric bone-headed fish from South America.
Yeah, the arapaima. They were a bycatch I experienced in pursuit of non-native alligator gar that were transplanted in Asia. They've got these things in Thailand called fishing parks, in which they basically throw a whole bunch of heavy-duty predators like Mekong catfish and arapaima and alligator gar into reservoirs to swim around with 100-pound carp and all sorts of crazy behemoths. So I had to go check that out.
You talk in your book a little bit about having to deal with the world of fishing parks and your relationship to them.
Right. Here you've got fish in a barrel, basically. You know, if you've got hundreds of giant fish in a man-made lake. Sure, they're in there, but that doesn't mean it's easy. It still takes a lot to get your bait in front of one of those fish. And, you know, I fish for days trying to catch an alligator gar in one of these things.
And 100 plus degrees.
So. Yeah, oh yeah. And it's hard to get them to bite, but then when they do, then you gotta use not just your own angling skills to bring them in, but you have to be really careful with these fish. Some of these arapaima in there are like 9 feet long, and they cost $4,000 to replace. So the fish hooks are barbless, so it's not to hurt them so much, and that means it's easier for the fish to slip off if you don't keep the line tight. And then when you get them in, you also have to be really careful about how you land them. And the fishing parks, they provide these special foam landing mats, so you bring the fish in and you get them on top of the foam so that when you take your money shot, if they fall out of your arms, they don't fall on the ground and get hurt.
You've traveled to Mexico,
mm-hmm.
and there they have things called gar farms.
Oh, yeah.
They're creating genomic banks to preserve all types of gar.
There's a university in Villahermosa, Mexico, and that's actually where the genomic banks are being worked on right now. They're collecting all these gar from all over the world, and they're reproducing them there. They're keeping them separate. It's like a garchive, I guess. And so the idea is that if a population crashes for whatever reasons, then they can go to this bank and get some gar fingerlings and replace the gone gar with the exact genetic gar from that area.
In contrast to the gar rodeo, in Tabasco, Mexico, there are tables set up in the square that sell t-shirts, baseball caps, plaques, pen holders, plates, candles, everything.
Peje Lagarto.
Peje Lagarto.
Yeah. The state of Tabasco in Mexico is crazy for gar. Gar are their culture down there. And it's been this way for centuries. Just like we have the American Eagle as our icon all over the place up here, the state of Tabasco has culture built on gar. They've got, you know, gar flags and, you know, gar, their gar tourist industry is really big. But basically, people in that area, millions of people have been eating gar for centuries. And then we got the petrochemical industry that came along and started polluting the water. And basically, there are 100 oil spills per year in that area of Mexico. The environment was destroyed by oil spills. So what happened was people started building these aquaculture facilities, which are gar farms, so that they can continue to eat gar and have gar as the center of their culture. And it's working.
My name is Lindsay Lewis. I'm with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. They grow alligator gar and tropical gar in Mexico, just like we do catfish here. And so it is conceivable someday that we could do that here. There's no reason why we couldn't. We certainly have the capabilities. There just doesn't exist a market right now sufficient to support culturing of those fish here.
So gar farms are what's preserving not just gar, tropical gar, in Tabasco, Mexico. It's also preserving the culture of the people.
Would you talk about the Mexican Adopt a Gar program?
Basically, school children are given a cup with a gar fingerling in it and some fish pellets, and they take the gar home and they feed the gar, and they observe the gar and they learn about the gar, and in the end they let the gar go to supplement the struggling wild populations. Of course, these kids and their parents then know about gar, and so they have a respect for gar, and unknowingly or not, they become activists in rebuilding compromised populations. Gar have challenged me to go places that I hadn't gone before, and gar have become my identity. Sometimes I even think about changing my name to gar.
So you kept fish. You've kept gar in tanks.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Would you talk about that just a little bit? Because I know it's an incredible amount of maintenance.
Yeah. Well, this gar I bought on eBay, actually. It was advertised as a crocodile gar, which I'd never heard of. And I contacted the guy, and he said that he was a fish hatchery guy down in Florida, and he had created this hybrid strain of long-nosed alligator gar. So ordered it, and it came in a plastic bag of water in a box through priority mail. And he was only 3 inches long when I got him. And I put him in a tank, and he grew, and I watched him for years, and he lived with other gar. And, it was a great pet. I could pet him, feed him by hand. And then he reached sexual maturity. And he'd go into his spawning colors every once in a while, and he would turn completely jet black. He was so cool looking. Yeah, it was great watching him, having him as a pet.
Without any warning, on March 29, 2013, the 65-year-old Pegasus Pipeline in Mayflower, Arkansas, burst.
It was a 22-foot rupture in a 20-inch diameter hose, originally designed to pump unrefined oil from the south to the north, where the refineries used to be. Now, however, it was pumping a rougher viscosity Canadian heavy crude tar sand oil in the opposite direction. The result was an estimated 3,500 to 5,000 barrels of toxic bitumen burbling up from a suburban lawn. It immediately filled the streets, flowed into rain gutters, found its way into a drainage creek, and spilled straight into Lake Conway, which is where I live.
Suddenly, Arkansas had a disaster on its hands, one of the hugest inland spills in American history.
Booms went out into the cove. The main lake's only defense was one mere levee with one culvert, where 30 toxic chemicals were spewing out. Meanwhile, rescue crews pulled out ducks, snakes, turtles, and all sorts of species slathered by disaster. I took my ecopoetics class down there to see the spill firsthand.
What did they see?
Oh, there's cleanup crews, there's sludge on the shore, there's booms, there's, oil-coated stuff all over the place. Yeah. And then the smell, they smell the toxic smell that creates those headaches. Yeah, we drove around, we saw the booms and the trucks and the giant machineries. They brought in the giant pumps and also the security details that were just chewing us away all the time.
What did your students say?
Oh, they became enraged. They all knew about the spill, but when I took them down there and they saw it, that really hit home for them. Meanwhile, there are gar out there, and even state record-sized spotted gar, which I've caught, eating crawdads and crustaceans and species of all sorts. The Arkansas Department of Environmental Quality found all sorts of elevated levels in Lake Conway for benzene, xylenes, anthracenes, a couple toxic metals, and a few other carcinogenic mutagens. Fishermen, though, are out there right now. They trust what the authorities are telling them, that it's okay to eat the fish. But would you feel comfortable eating those fish or feeding them to your family, not knowing exactly what they contain? Anyway, I'm working on this now. I'm collecting specimens from the lake, and I've got a lab that's testing them, and you can be sure that I'll let the people know what I discover. So, this toxicity, unfortunately, became a metaphor for a point I'd reached in my life. With the warmer weather, the contaminations were becoming more common. I considered letting my gar go. After all, I'd had it 10 years, and after this illness was vanquished, there'd be more to follow. Technically, my gar should have been at least 6 feet long, but its growth had been stunted by a once-a-day feeding schedule that I'd been robotically following for a decade. I figured that in freeing him, I'd free myself from all that Mobius maintenance, but ultimately, I wanted my gar to be free and to experience all the joys and terrors that came with that, just like me. Besides, what else could I learn from observing him that I hadn't learned in the past 10 years? It was time to let him go. When his health returned, I put him in a blue plastic tub and drove him to the Arkansas River. It was an emotional thing for me to do, but as I kept reminding myself, this wasn't a dog, this wasn't a cat. It had no human feelings. Plus, what I was feeling was only nostalgia, something it couldn't feel for me.
But it's hard loving something that don't love you, but you tried out anyways. And your blood runs cold and your feet do too, and I heard you say you don't mind.
Deeper down though, I knew that what I was feeling was way more profound than just letting go of something I loved. I was trying to free something in myself, something that had become routine, something that I needed to change in order to grow as a human being. But when I lowered my gar into the river, he hovered there in my hands, not taking off. It was as if he didn't want to leave the security he'd known been enclosed in tanks all his life.
Well, I know where you're going, and so do you. I'll see you again sometime.
Then he started motoring off, slowly and cautiously. For the first time in his existence, there wasn't a glass wall 2 feet from his nose. And I think this frightened him. There were sticks beneath him, rocks, current. He swam a foot and then another, then 3 feet, 4 feet, 5 feet, still swimming on the surface. As he reached the 6 foot mark, the 7 foot mark, never looking back, his coppery color suddenly struck me. He'd taken on this metallic glimmer from living in a sodium sulfa treated tank for the last week, and his black tiger stripes were highly defined. Without question, he was the coolest looking guard ever seen. And just as quickly as this realization hit me, he was gone. If we don't monitor our resources and assess their state of health enough, and if we don't keep our eye on the eco ball and do what needs to be done, and if we don't protect what's going on and give wildness the attention it deserves, we risk falling into an indifferent slump and getting burned on the most important thing we've got, a system that's as fragile as hell, which can be destroyed in a nanosecond.
I went down to save my soul. I went down, oh Lord. I went down to that old river, never come back no more.
Ultimately, though, your book has an optimistic message.
If you ask me, our best defense against losing what's most important, including our identities and our existence, is to keep feeding the imagination by preserving the most fantastic elements in our midst. Like the alligator gar, a creature so strange and provocative of nightmares and dreams that it makes us ask who our monsters really are.
Broadcast from the University District, this has been a special program on KUAR 89.1. Thanks for joining us. Arts and Letters and other programming that airs on this station can be found at KUAR.org. Leave us a comment there and let us know what you've thought about the program. Also, check out the supplemental section of the webpage for this show for excerpts from interviews with leading alligator gar researchers. Thank you to the Sioux City Kid, who supplied the theme music for today's show.
Water that rolls so gently. May you tread and never drown.
Thank you to Know Who's a Robot for the gar music. Thank you to gar experts Dr. Reed Adams from the University of Central Arkansas and Lindsay Lewis from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Thank you to the garvastatingly talented Chris Hickey, who helps us produce these shows. Thank you to writer and professor Mark Spitzer, whose gar books help us to understand and love this misunderstood creature. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, leaving you with the words of William Shakespeare's character Edgar in King Lear, who proclaims at the end of the play, "The oldest hath borne most."
I go, I go, I go, I go.